Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute, who supports Radio Liberty, and we're going to be talking about genetic engineering. Now, we hear a lot about genetic engineering and about improving crops, and I think everybody's in favor of improving crops, but it's not a matter of improving crops, it's how you go about improving crops. And is there a problem with genetic engineering? Well, we know there have been examples where, for instance, they had genetically engineered corn and they fed it to pigs. And the pigs became infertile, and the pig farmers began going broke because they weren't having the little pigs to replace the pigs that were being butchered. And there have been other examples where there's genetic potatoes described in Jeffrey Smith's book that we carry, called Seeds of Deception. And, of course, the genetically engineered potatoes, when they were fed to animals, the animals all died. Of course, when the scientist reported that, the industries that had involved in genetic engineering certainly made his life miserable, because we're to believe that these genetically engineered foods are just like all other foods, but, well, that really isn't true, is it, Jerry?
No, it's not true at all, Dr. Stan, and I've always bemoaned the fact to you that we never seem to have a smoking gun that holds to be able to connect the differences in genetically engineered food with a disease or a problem or a toxicological effect. But I think that has just changed this week, when brought to international attention was a study done on rats using genetically modified corn done by Monsanto, fed to 400 rats, and in the study it ended up that the male rats in the experimental group had developed, and statistically significant, by the way, numbers of them, had developed smaller kidneys and defects in their blood cells.
Well, I certainly would be very, very happy that the Monsanto released that study. How is that? Because that is very unusual. Usually these big corporations will conceal the data or just will lie about it. Monsanto actually published that and put it forward?
As a matter of fact, they are acknowledging it on their website that this study was done. I have gone through the study. I've gone through the experimental design. They refused to release the entire study. Apparently, the French became aware of this study a year ago and asked to have the complete study released. They have refused to release the complete study because they said it would give them an unfair commercial disadvantage, that others who are their competitors might find information in the study that would be useful. And, of course, the international community is now saying this is nothing but hogwash. If they didn't have something to hide, then certainly they would agree to release it.
Well, now, so, this was what sort of a genetically engineered product?
This is MON-863, a genetically modified corn product that resists corn rootworm pest. And I could give you all of the details and let you know that you and I are eating this stuff here in the United States.
We really are. In other words, has this already been...
2003. It's already out in our fields all over the United States since 2003. and it has been released for animal and human consumption based
hold that on... Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Dr. Derek Guidetti. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And for those of you who don't know about Jerry, she is actually a genetic engineer. You were trained and actually you worked in this, didn't you, at college level?
Yes, I have done this for years and at the PhD level. And I have done this research. I know how to manipulate the genes. I am not working in it now. I have become very concerned about the potential for this technology to cause harm. It has potential for good. However, it is my belief that the way it is being used by some of these multinational companies for the human food supply presents a very grave and imminent danger to all peoples on the earth. And that's not an overstatement. We have here released now in the past few days the Sunday Independent in the United Kingdom finally brought this to international attention this past Sunday, stating that this rat study, based on 400 rats, only 400 rats, to release this to the public, this corn, for animal and human consumption. I was stunned. As a scientist, I can tell you that to release a product to the public and to all animals based on a single study of 400 rats with a bunch of so-called experts gathered together to look at the results of that study and give it a rubber stamp of approval is astoundingly narrow. Astoundingly narrow. How can you make a statement based on 400 rats that is going to be safe for consumption by humans and animals? And that's exactly what they did. I actually went to Monsanto's website, Monsanto UK and Monsanto US. You can read the study yourself, and you can see that they indeed recognize that. Here's a direct quote. The study included 400 rats divided into 10 groups of 20 male and female animals and fed diets containing either the MON-863, the one that's genetically modified, or the control, which is the same kind of grain without the genes in it. During the course of the study, more than 900 statistical comparisons were made between test and control animals. Based on chance alone, several statistically significant differences were expected that were not biologically meaningful. That's to prepare you for the fact that there were differences. Then it goes on, all the experts agreed that the results were within normal, etc. And then it says...
Hold that thought. We're going to just bring all of our stations right back
on. Sure.
Just about right now.
All right.
Well, that's Dr. Stan, and our guest is Jerry Guidetti. And Jerry, of course, is a genetic engineer. And she has a PhD in genetic engineering. She's worked at this for many years and then really became concerned as to what is really being done. And she was telling us about this study that had been done by Monsanto before this genetically engineered corn was released for animals and for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they didn't tell everybody what was really in the study. In fact, a lot of the study wasn't released because, after all, we have, you know, the proprietary secrets, and we can't have other people knowing how dangerous our products are, and certainly not the public. So, anyway, this was released, but the corn was released, and we've been eating it. Now, why was it that Monsanto even released even part of the study? Was it because of the pressure from the French? I mean, I know the Europeans certainly are not being experimented on the way our government is experimenting on us.
Well, that's exactly what they did. They released, as they said, one of their folks responded with respect to that not being released. He says, this is not the case. Monsanto has provided all required data and studies, including the subject rat study, to European regulatory authorities, and EFSA reviewed these studies before issuing its opinion. He said the product that has been grown commercially in the United States and Canada since 2003 is safe. And it goes on to say a scientific panel even published a statement on 29 October 2004 verifying this. The company insists, therefore, that the research does not provide evidence of any hidden dangers in biotechnology, only, this is unbelievable, only inconsequential differences in kidney size and blood composition in the animals used. The astounding thing is those inconsequential kidney size differences and blood differences only occurred in the genetically engineered fed, grain-fed rats. They did not occur in the control rats at all.
All right. Now, what about the blood changes? Do we have any idea what they really
No, they will not release the rest of that study. They have not released the study. And the global community is banging on them to do exactly that.
Well, has Europe agreed to accept this this genetic
Yes, certain groups in Europe. As a matter of fact, I have Monsanto's list of all of the chronology and summary of opinions. And they have the rat 90-day dietary feeding study, so on. And the quote is, toxicological parameters evaluated were survival, et cetera. And then they say there were no test article-related changes in any of the aforementioned toxicological parameters. That is one quote. Here's the Robert Koch Institute. From this extensive study, it can be deduced that even after long-term oral exposure, mind you, that's 90 days, to MON-863 maize kernels, no harmful effects are to be expected. They didn't say they didn't occur. Are to be expected. Then they have a next one, Novel Food Assessment, EF, a European group, will not have adverse effect on human and animal health. Mind you, again, Dr. Stan, 400 rats for 90 days determined that this corn will not have an adverse effect on human and animal health. Can you imagine?
Feeding it to millions of people. I mean, this
can you imagine? Can you?
Well, I think we only have it for our listeners. We only have to look back at, for instance, it was back in the 1960s and 1970s when they were giving women the estrogens to
yes.
prevent this albesterol, to prevent miscarriages.
Yes.
And then they found that their daughters had an aggressive cancer of the vagina, and they would have to simply excise everything.
Right.
And then if those women had already had children, their children had it. In other words, they used the American people for experiments on the long-term effect of albesterol, and they knew exactly what they were doing, because we have a report. It came out of a group of intellectuals who got together back in 1962 under the auspices of SIBA. It's called the Man and His Future, the SIBA Symposium. And they were talking about, well, we won't know for a generation the end result of what we're doing with the estrogens we're giving to these women. So you have to understand they're really experimenting on us. And this is why you're going to have to protect yourself, because the government is not going to. We know very well, and those of you who haven't read my April newsletter, why, we'll be glad to send you one.
It was excellent, by the way.
Well, thank you. Basically, it was the story of Vioxx. It was Dr. Graham's testimony before the Senate, which, of course, was never covered by your local newspaper, at least not in detail. And what he brought out was that they knew before Vioxx was ever released on the market, and we saw on our television screen the picture of the woman skating gracefully across this pond with the children in tow. I don't know how many remember that beautiful picture, that we implanted in our minds how wonderful Vioxx was, and all the pain was gone. They knew before the drug was released in 1970, the 090 study had shown a 700% increase in heart attacks in people who took this product. And with no warning to the doctors and no warning, to the patients, they released this, and tens of thousands of Americans died because of that. Eventually, Merck was forced to take it off the market. And then, of course, they had a panel of experts that were called in to appraise and find out that they should have taken Merck the Vioxx off the market. 10 of the experts were being paid by the drug companies, drug manufacturing companies, and it was amazing that 9 out of 10 of those experts, or I think 10 out of the 10 of the experts, when the vote came, they all voted in favor of putting Vioxx back on the market. And with the rest of the experts, why, the vast majority were against it. But I suppose when you pack the panel, you can pretty well you pretty well get the result. And we carry this over into genetic engineered food. Ladies and gentlemen, there are people working in our government who are not concerned about your health. Please don't look to the FDA for your protection. So, anyway, what about Europe? I thought Europe was pretty well fighting
Europe has been fighting it. As a matter of fact, one group there, CGB, and I don't have the that acronym is for, requested more precise interpretation of the selected data, that data on the kidney malformations and the blood disorder. And it says, literally, and they put this one not in bold like all of the other reassuring ones. This one they put in regular type, and they quote, in the absence of additional confirmatory studies, the committee of the CGB is not able to definitively conclude on the absence of any risk to animal health. And so there you have it, and that's put in regular typeface, and all of the rest of them are put in gold, bold typeface. And there's, you see, the key phrase there is, in the absence of additional confirmatory studies, you do not release a genetically modified organism to consumption by everyone in the on the globe, as well as all of the pollen from these plants, contaminating all of the other corn that is not genetically modified. You don't release it based on a study of 90 days, call that long term, and based on 400 rats?
Well, of course, the thing
is... And then
is,
those results.
But can we trust Monsanto? You would think that the FDA would require independent laboratory studies, not something financed by Monsanto, because, well, anybody knows, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
That's right.
And Monsanto is dishonest. And we, if you don't believe that, we have a wonderful book written by Marshall Angel called, What You Should Know About the Drug Companies. And then, of course, we know what they did as far as NutraSweet is concerned. We hear about the epidemic of obesity. And it was known long ago that if you fed rats NutraSweet, why they became pathologically obese. And, of course, it also produced brain tumors and all sorts of other tumors. And yet Monsanto, first of all, Jay Searle, and then Monsanto bought the patent, and they put that out knowing full well that so much of the pathological obesity we're seeing today is directly related to the product that they put on the market and kept on the market. And now we're supposed to trust a study they did of 400 rats. Well, what about the media? I know I haven't read much about this, and I'm reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, and three or four other newspapers. This is not getting in the headlines.
No, as a matter of fact, if it wasn't for the UK breaking the story on Sunday, it would not have hit the American press. And if you go on to Google or another search engine and you put in Monsanto leaked study, you will begin to pull this information up. You know, one thing we should do, Dr. Stan, for everyone's understanding, too, is to understand that this particular corn variety is genetically modified not in one specific part of the plant, just like the ear of corn, but the entire plant, every single part of the plant, has a gene in it that produces a protein that is normally produced by a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis. Now, Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, is something we organic gardeners were able to use for many years. It's a natural bacterium. It sounds nice, doesn't it? It's a natural bacterium. It's present in the soil. And when it is dusted on the leaves of plants, caterpillars who are eating those plants ingest that bacterium. Well, the bacteria normally forms a spore, an oval spore. And during that spore formation, it forms a protein crystal. The spore is eaten by the larvae of a moth and European corn borer, for example, and root borers. The spore is eaten. It gets into the gut of the larva or the caterpillar, and it causes paralysis of the gut. The caterpillar stops eating. It dies in approximately one day. It stops eating within 6 hours, and the plant is saved. Well, now, instead of letting nature do its own thing with BT, like us organic gardeners have been doing for all of these years, they've decided to put that protein crystal gene inside every cell of the plant so that the toxin is in every single cell of the corn plant.
And we get to eat it just
we
like
get
the moth does.
It.
Just like
correct.
The larva.
Absolutely. We get to eat it.
Well, have they done any human studies at all to prove it safe? Are they simply going?
Absolutely not. We are the lab rats.
And I think that's so important, ladies and gentlemen. Understand, they're experimenting on you. They're experimenting with all sorts of things, but we'll talk more about that later here at Radio Liberty. Well, Jerry, how can we tell whether or not the corn we are going to buy at the store, you know, the ear corn, we just love it. The corn comes in this time of year, and I love eating good corn, but is there any way we can tell whether this has been genetically modified? Is there any way we can protect ourselves?
And there is no way that you can tell that any corn that you get at the market is genetically modified by any of its sweetness or whatever, or its appearance. You can find out where it came from. You can find out who grew it. If you buy corn that is locally grown and you don't live in an area where there's a lot of commercial agriculture, and the farmer who grows it, the grower, tells you what kind of seed he used, you may have some control over this.
But even if he's using the right seeds, can't the pollen from adjacent fields get then modify his product as well?
That's right. As a matter of fact, those who have known the Ark Institute for years know that we grew for years our seed stocks in Ohio. However, the commercial corn crops were creeping in on us. There was so much genetically modified corn being grown 1 and 2 miles away from us that we had to stop growing corn there because we could not assure our customers of GMO-free corn because the pollen is carried in the wind. Of course, our own USDA and French companies and so on had assured us that it was impossible for the pollen to travel more than 50 to 100 feet outside of a field of corn, contaminating it, and they can put trap crops around it to catch the pollen before it went in the wind. It was absolutely laughable. We have now spread this genetically modified pollen all the way down to the far reaches of Mexico, where it was kind of the cradle of corn civilization, if you will, and we've contaminated those folks' corn all the way down there, and it is the saddest thing because it's from there where we have the genetic diversity that we depend on in order to save the human race one day by being able to reach out and get some of those genes that have been here since the beginning of time. And we unfortunately have now contaminated it with some of these CRY proteins, these toxic proteins that came from BT. The other thing this has done is it has presented this protein to all of the caterpillars in this country and wherever else this stuff is grown to the point where the caterpillars are now going to become immune or inured to this particular protein, this toxin, so that we organic growers who depended on this natural bacterium that we could actually sprinkle on the leaves of our plants so that the caterpillars would be killed, we can't even use that anymore once they become immune to the effects of this particular protein. But scarier still is, what effects is it having on human intestines? What about human kidneys? We've got kidney size differences in a handful of rats. You would think that this, if this was such a rare event, you would never see it. In 200 of the 400 rats, you've got two groups here, 200 in the experimental group, 200 in the control group. And among the 200 in the experimental group, and we don't have the numbers that showed these kidney defects, and these blood defects, I can tell you that 200 rats does not a large population make. And if you've got effects showing up in those few animals...
Hold that thought right there, Jerry. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Jerry has been saying that basically the pollen has been spread from the fields that are growing this genetically modified corn with a BT in it, this special toxin. Now, and it is simply not in the ears of corn, it's every cell within the plants as well. But then now the pollen is being spread, and of course, they guarantee it wouldn't go more than 50 feet or 50 yards or something, and But of course, as always, they lied. And Jerry is saying that it's gone all the way down almost to Mexico, or has it gotten into Mexico?
Through Mexico. I don't speak Spanish, so Oaxaca, is that how you pronounce it? O-A-X-A-C-A. It's gone all the way down to that province or that area of Mexico, which is the center of corn civilization, if you will. That's where it all originated. Unfortunately, we shipped corn down there. They bought it. They bought it for not growing, but for feed. And, of course, as soon as the locals saw the nice big size and uniformity of the kernels, they said, oh, hey, let's plant some of this. Let's see what grows out of it. And unfortunately, and yet they knew this would happen. Of course they knew this would happen. They didn't have to get permission to send genetically modified seed down there. All they have to do is send it down, and nature will take its course. As soon as you have a plant growing, you've got pollen blowing in the wind. And it's cross-pollinating with their own native varieties that, you know, God-given biodiversity from thousands of years when corn was in its grass stages. There are such primitive corns down there that scientists relish getting a hold of so that they can preserve the genes for our genetic heritage. You know, one day, well, it's already happened so many times, massive diseases come through, corn diseases come through, and wipe out 30%, 40% of crop growing in an area, but no problem. There are other corns that have resistance to those diseases because of all of the biodiversity, all of the genes that have come down through the line through evolution, that have been preserved. And, you know, we're not talking about God made Adam and Eve here. I'm talking evolving genes within, organisms. When plants, like humans, become exposed to assaults from their environment, the ones who survive are the ones who have some kind of built-in resistance.
The survival of the fittest.
That's correct. Absolutely. It's Darwinian. It's survival of the fittest. You can talk about, you know, a horrible new influenza coming through, and you may have a very small handful, a remnant of people who will survive because somewhere in their genetic heritage happened to be a gene that came from an ancestor who was exposed to the exact same kind of virus. Well, the same thing with plants, and it is so critical that we retain this biodiversity on this planet because it is the assurance that life will go on.
Well, Chris, but now we have these scientists who, you know, for whatever reason, seem to be interested in modifying the basic pattern of genes that God had created that had allowed this tremendous diversity you're talking about, and in these incredible methods, and whether they're putting in Roundup Ready genes or whether they're putting in the BT genes or all sorts of other genes, man is going to try to play God. And really, I'm very, very concerned that we are opening Pandora's box, the genie's out of the bottle. The toothpaste is out of the tube, and ladies and gentlemen, where is it going to end? Because there's no going back. And tragically, why we may very well have created a Frankenstein monster, and we're already beginning, if you begin looking at some of the things, and we begin noticing more and more people are having more and more problems and new allergies, and but I think that the story of this genetically modified food, corn, we won't know what it's going to do for several generations.
Right. We won't, and we may end up already having children with all kinds of intestinal problems that we don't even know. Again, smoking gun, it's very, very difficult to prove, and there are no tests being done right now in U.S. medical laboratories that test for Cry1A, Cry1AB, or any of these proteins. All they will begin to notice is changes, are changes, within particular organs. Now, that's not to say that this is going to happen, Dr. Stan. The point is, it is very likely that it is going to happen because we have seen already in a very small population of rats a statistically significant occurrence of abnormalities, and they literally brush that off and say, you would expect a certain amount of abnormalities in a population this size of rats, da-da-da-da. Well, then why didn't they occur also statistically in the other 200 rats that were not fed this particular genetically modified.
Well, I think really what's so frightening is the fact that we cannot trust the Federal Drug Administration.
Oh, not at all.
And, you know, if there are no independent studies, when there is you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of profit, do you think that people would risk human lives just for profit? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Jerry Guidetti of the Arc Institute. And when, of course, our stations come back, we're going to tell you a little bit about the Arc Institute and how you can get their seeds. They actually, Jerry, has these seeds and standard seeds, the old-fashioned healthy seeds. And, of course, she makes them available to you on a regular basis and teach you how to collect the seeds at the end of the season so you can grow the products on your own in the years to come. Unfortunately, we one day may very well have to tend our own gardens, or we're not going to be able to depend upon what we have in the past, commercially grown food, because we don't know what they're going to do to many of the items out there. And they're creating genetically altered tomatoes, aren't they? And strawberries. I noticed the strawberries now don't grow old and soft like they used to. Oh, tell us what's happening to some of the other products.
Yeah, well, in the case of strawberries, for example, they are clones, and they are looking for strawberries that are hard, firm, easy to ship, that ripen slowly in the container, don't go to ripening and molding quickly. And if you've tasted any of those giant strawberries with the white bottoms on them, and you remember what a real strawberry tastes like, you realize that these aren't strawberries. This is a whole different beast. Some of them are the size of plums. You know, they're so gigantic. Oh, yes, they're exceedingly impressive, and they ship very well, but they don't have anything like the flavor. You know, I have compared for years, way back to Y2K, the genetic code with the kind of computer code, and any change you make in the code inside a cell is kind of like what happens when you change code on a computer. The effect is not limited just to one specific area in that code. You don't know the effect it's going to have anywhere else in that computer, what it's going to do to a particular program, what kind of malfunction it's going to do. Well, take that concept, multiply it thousands of times over with respect to the cell. There are so many areas of genetics in cells that we don't understand. Molecular biology has not figured out what each gene produces, every single protein, and where that protein acts, either on a place inside the cell or on other parts of the genome for regulation. And we have introduced these novel components, for example, this protein, inside every cell of a plant. Now, here's an example of the kind of effect that it's already having, and Monsanto acknowledged this years ago. It was determined that with this protein in every single leaf of corn in a field, that the monarch butterfly, which migrates across the United States and goes back to Mexico.
Right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti, who is a genetic engineer. But now she's trying to let people understand what this is all about. And she's pointing out that even Monsanto will acknowledge that the monarch butterfly, and we pick up the story there.
Okay. Yeah, that it has been estimated by some scientists that the monarch butterfly, which migrates from the United States down to Mexico, I believe it's southern Mexico, it has a caterpillar stage, and that caterpillar stage is here in the United States. Well, the caterpillars land and eat some of these plants that have the pollen on them from these genetically modified plants, and it has been estimated that 25% of the monarchs were being killed just by this corn. And so they finally had to admit, Monsanto and other companies that do genetically modified corn with BT in it, that indeed about 25% of the monarch crop might be killed, but that was acceptable. I've read this in the press, that it was acceptable to lose. Excuse me. Is it acceptable to have the loss of 25% of dogs or 25% of cattle? Because it's a monarch butterfly, this is acceptable losses?
But of
course, keep in mind that that's a that BT protein kills larval forms of good and bad butterflies, moths, and so on. Not to mention what effect it's going to have on the guts, kidneys, blood of mammals, other insects, soil organisms. We have no idea.
Well, I know we're just trying to play God, and sometimes when man plays God, we get into real problems. Well, Jerry, before we go on,
yes.
I want, of course, to have you tell our listeners a little bit about the Ark Institute and what they can get through you and through your organization.
Sure. The Ark Institute, I was the founder of the Ark Institute. I founded it because I was very concerned about the disappearance of all of our heirloom seeds, our natural seeds that were not genetically modified. Saw the writing on the wall, realized that they had to be protected from the pollen blowing in the wind if I was to protect them at all, and we began raising our own, multiplying them, preserving our rights to raise our own food, save our own seeds, and plant them year after year. We did this back in 1996. We have been offering collections of various sizes to folks who are interested in preserving these natural non-GMO, non-hybrid seeds, the ones that have fed humans since humans turned to agriculture to live. And they are disappearing. So they can get seed packages from 20 varieties or 40 in a collection. They are very generous packets. This isn't 10 seeds in a packet. You can get hundreds of seeds in a packet. And you can literally feed a family on them. They can get that way. They can go to our website, arkinstitute.com, www.arkinstitute.com, or they can call, if you're not on a computer, 1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912. We offer packages that have simple books to teach you how to save your own seed, how to protect your seed from contamination, how to multiply your seed and give them away. We ask you, don't depend on us for seed. Give them away as gifts, the way humans have done since the beginning of time. Give them as gifts to folks and ask them to multiply them and keep this earth populated with God-given biodiversity to try to keep things going on this planet a bit longer.
And again, that number is, give that number
1-800-255-1912.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, why, give us a call of 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I think this is a very, very important subject. We carry several books on genetically modified food. One is, of course, Seeds of Deception, Jeffrey Smith's book. We have the GMO, Beware GMO Foods, and some of the stories in there, you know, about these poor farmers who fed the genetically modified corn to their pigs, and suddenly all the pigs are sterile. What do we know about the long-term effects of these from generation to generation? We don't know. They're experimenting on the human people, on the population of this country, and the European people over in the European common market are doing everything they can to keep GMO foods out of there. But then they're a lot smarter over there than we are. They won't allow water fluoridation. They won't allow a lot of the products that we have in this country in over there. Even their dental practices are different because they're concerned about their people, and they're not subject to lobby pressure from groups that have a vested interest in doing wrong. Or perhaps they have know exactly what they're doing. I'm not certain. But I will tell you that over in Europe, I hate to say this, but it would appear that their governments have a lot more concern for the health of their people than the people in the Federal Drug Administration in Washington, D.C., many of whom are looking forward to a comfortable retirement working for the drug companies that they've used to regulate. And we know, for instance, in the NIH, that many of the people at the NIH, the National Institute of Health, were receiving large stipends and subsidies from the drug companies as they were drawing down their very, very sizable federal salaries. When you have a country that's lost its moral foundation, where corporate executives lie, where people working in government lie, where the President of the United States can lie and get away with it. Mm-hmm. Why should we be surprised when people working, for the drug companies and for companies like Monsanto and other companies that produce genetically modified food should just fudge the figures a little bit? After all, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars profit. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Do you really feel comfortable now knowing that your corn has been tested on 400 rats? Well, 200 rats, really, because 200 of them really weren't given it at all.
Right.
And they will not tell us how many had modified kidney size. They won't tell us what the changes were in the blood. They won't tell us what happens from generation to generation, because they don't know.
Mm-hmm. And I was astounded. I have to tell you, I was truly astounded to find out that the study was that small. I was astounded that those so-called expert panels and organizations were manipulated into making these statements, but one has to ask, how can you call yourself a scientist if you're looking at the results on 200 rats who receive these things and you see abnormalities in kidneys? And abnormalities in the blood studies, and you don't see them in the control, how can you then be talked into believing that, one, it's insignificant or inconsequential? Excuse me, tell that to the rat with the inadequate kidney size or the blood disease, that it's inconsequential. How can you take that and extrapolate it over the entire global population of people and animals that will be feeding on these plants? It's impossible. If you take this particular GMO, this particular organism, this corn with this one thing, and then you add to it the fact that they are pushing hog wild full force to get the Terminator out there too, which terminates the ability of seed to grow at all, you are looking at a prescription for a threat to global food supply like none other. For folks who have never been to the ARC Institute's website, for example, hit the food supply update button. That's a free newsletter. You can read that. I have been so busy for the past 3 years that I haven't written new ones based on this the latest evidence. I've been doing most of it on the air and in talks across this country, but I have to tell you that you will find things there that are going to raise your hair on end. The Terminator article that I wrote in 1998 will just begin to disclose to you some of the problems that are going to occur as a result of releasing this technology. And then we have something like 38 Terminators now produced. This is paid for with our tax money, by the way, and multinational corporations around the world are developing them in order to assure us that their seeds are not going to be able to be grown again next year. Seed will not be able to be saved. And the Canadian government, unfortunately, is working just as the U.S. government is to assure that these things are going to get through. You can find things now all over the Internet from around the world that aren't appearing in U.S. papers about passports being denied to top global scientists who are in favor of allowing their peoples to save seed. Africa, for example, they're sending their global scientist specialist who is supposed to plead with the UN up in Montreal, Canada this week for the retention of the right of the African peoples to save seed, to feed themselves. And he was suddenly denied his passport this week and could not enter Canada.
Well, of course, if you understand that there really is tremendous pressure, prejudice against the black. And if you read some of the things that I read and understand, there are people who would really like to kill off a large part of the black population. What better way than to deprive them of the ability to save seeds, where they would be forced, of course, to use the Terminator seeds? And what happens if you can't get them the next year? Well, let's go to Darlene, who's calling us from New Jersey. Hi, Darlene. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi. I want to ask a couple questions. Now, I'm on the opposite side of the state in New Jersey.
Right.
And now, I know farmers that have, like, greenhouses. Like, if they use these types of seeds and everything, would you know, would anything be able to get, it wouldn't penetrate the greenhouse or anything, would it?
Well, it can't penetrate the plastic of the greenhouse, but greenhouses are vented with gigantic fans. I mean, we here at the Arc Institute have a very large commercial greenhouse, and we have 3-foot fans at both ends, and we circulate air throughout that greenhouse as well. So, yes, indeed, air is pumped out one end of the greenhouse and in the other end of the greenhouse, and pollen can spread out. However, I have to tell you, Darlene, that corn is grown out in the open. It is a wind-pollinated plant. It is not an insect-pollinated plant. And generally, corn is grown outside. You can do it artificially in a greenhouse, but it's pretty difficult to do. It's grown in test plots outside.
Well, now, what about the tomatoes, things like that? Right. Aren't they growing in greenhouses?
Yes, they're grown in greenhouses, and you can pollinate tomato plants simply by taking their stakes in the center and shaking the plant. And you shake it, and pollen goes, most of those flowers are complete flowers, and the pollen goes from the stamen to the stigma right there inside the flowers. And so you don't have the problem. You don't need to have an insect going from one to the other. As a matter of fact, with some of the old variety tomatoes, you'll occasionally find a double flower, and you'll find a bee going inside of it. That's a very rare event in a tomato's life. You don't need to have that for pollination, insect pollination. So the plants that grow very well in greenhouse situations are either very closely controlled because of scientific studies, and we pollinate using little brushes, paint brushes, for example, going from one plant to the other. We're playing bee, if you will, going from one to the other. Or you grow things for crops in a greenhouse, and then you don't rely on pollination at all, cross-pollination. Generally, those plants, like lettuces, for example, beets, carrots, strawberries, things like that, you can do in a greenhouse surroundings. But as far as this corn is concerned, the chances that a New Jersey grower is growing corn inside a greenhouse is slim to none, but you've got plenty of commercial corn being grown around. One thing the USDA never did explain to folks is that there is no controlling wind. Excuse me. How can you say that pollen isn't going to spread more than 50 feet outside a field of corn when, in fact, all across the great Midwest, the corn belt in the United States, you have gigantic winds sweeping over every spring, every fall. We have tornadoes. We have hurricanes. These winds carry things. You've got frogs raining down on different areas in different states carried by the wind. You think pollen isn't going to rain down from the wind? Of course it is.
Anything else you'd like to ask, darling?
Yeah, I had saw this advertisement for, like, if you live in an apartment that they have planters that you can grow things in your own home. Now, what's the feasibility of, you know, what you can grow in your own home?
Okay, it all depends on lights. You can grow things indoors, but you need those really big lights with the domes. They're very expensive, although I've seen relatively less expensive ones over these past several years. The technology is getting a whole lot better.
How about if you have a big porch, can you grow things
yes,
in these?
Yes, if you have the correct lighting. But then in the wintertime and in early spring, you'll have to supplement some with lights. Now you can use regular, cheap fluorescent fixtures to grow things up to, say, half the size of a leaf lettuce. You can grow them up that size. But then they really do have to have outside light or some of these big grow lights that really have the full spectrum and the intensity that you need. And so, yes, you definitely want to do that. I do want to give you a warning, though. There is a federal program that they are obtaining lists of folks who grow things with these lights indoors because of growing plants that aren't legal, you understand? Yes, and so you will go on one of these lists, apparently, and all I say that to you for is certainly anybody who buys these lights should only be growing really food and house plants.
Can't be growing marijuana.
That's correct.
You could, like, if you're growing something for food, you could put it on the porch, like, in the summertime.
Absolutely. I encourage folks to grow as much food as they can on patios and porches. You could grow food in just the plastic soil bags, you know, that you buy at a nursery.
Yeah.
You can go to organic soil growing mixes with fertilizer in, or fertilizer you put in yourself, organic fertilizer. There are granular organic fertilizers, slow-release ones now available on the market. And you can poke with a big meat fork, poke holes in the bags, and stand them up one against each other, cut the top open, put in a tomato plant, and water it from the top. Just make sure your holes allow a leakage or seepage of the excess water out the bottom, and you've got yourself a little farm. Just be sure that whatever you're growing it on can support the weight of these bags of soil, because once you put water in them, they get pretty heavy. But you can certainly grow a lot of food. I would go for something, certainly not corn in any great quantity, but you could certainly grow hundreds and hundreds of pounds of tomatoes in a few bags on a patio. You can grow beets and carrots and lettuce, green beans, for example. It will all grow.
Okay.
That's all right, your question, darling. Sure.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I guess it's been Jerry Quattetti, and of course we're going to be back here for just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. But I think this is such an important issue. It's an important subject, and you need to have the information on this. And you need to understand that they use the American people as guinea pigs. They did that with the sildenafil, and then they waited to see what was happening. And we know that they realized exactly what was happening. And they said, well, we'll take a generation. And, well, it was not just one generation, but a second generation, and perhaps even a third generation of young women, of course, who many of them will never have children because of the experiments that were done. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Quattetti, and we've been talking about the fantastic information that's coming out on this corn. Now, have they genetically modified other types, other genetic modifications of corn besides this BT corn?
Yes, there is corn, different kinds of BT corn based on the European corn borer, others for root borers. It's a whole different game. Then we have the Roundup Ready resistance, which is also being placed into corn, but it's also being placed into soybeans, as you know, and in lots of other plants. They are threatening to, and they will do it. They're going to. They've already got it bred. Roundup Ready wheat, that will mean that the staff of life, if you will, our bread, is also contaminated with resistance to this particular chemical in Roundup.
But do we know what the long-term effect is on human
beings?
We do
not
know.
We do not know if their idea of long-term study is 90 days with 200 rats eating that particular grain. Dr. Stan, we can be in the biggest trouble. That is only to get through the door of permission to grow it and to get it into a country. I am astounded, absolutely astounded, that they have been able to open these doors. But when you consider that so many of the land-grant institutions, well, all of them here in the United States, the land-grant institutions, the ones that were granted land from the federal government in order to grow agricultural products and train farmers and help to grow this great land, those institutions have put up big buildings, scientific research programs, and so on, that are funded in smaller amounts by the federal government and in larger amounts by multinational corporations. They build them big, beautiful buildings. They do research hand in hand, and if these professors want to do their research, they have to apply for grants. The grants are largely supported by funding from these companies. You know that you are not going to be able to produce results that are negative.
And if you do, of course, you'll never get another grant.
You'll never get another grant.
And this is the way the game is played, ladies and gentlemen. And you must understand that, you know, I don't know where the money's going to come from, but if we cannot depend upon it coming from the corporations that want to get specific results, and they're going to get the results that they want to, and if you won't give them the results, why, they'll get somebody else who will,
absolutely,
and they'll simply conceal the study that you did that tells the truth. Hey, we're out of time. God bless you, Jerry.
God Thanks bless for you too, Dr.
Good night.
Stan.
Well, This is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our program. I know I always enjoy talking to Jerry. She's got a tremendous amount of information, and hopefully
she'll be with
us on a regular basis here, and every once a month, you'll be able to keep abreast of what's really going on. Now, if you would like more information on genetically modified food, let me suggest Jeffrey Smith's excellent book entitled Seeds of Deception. And then we carry a small little book. It's called GMO, Beware GMO Foods, or Beware GMO. And then we have a four-tape set we put together on genetic engineering. You really need to understand the background of the genetically modified food craze, or call it what you will. But they are endangering the health of our people. And you're going to have to start being careful yourself, and you're going to have to start growing your own food, and I think Jerry's idea. Now, you're not going to be able to grow corn or wheat or things of that sort, and I don't know what we're going to do as more and more of this food is contaminated by these genetic engineering experiments. If you really want to understand how truly diabolical a lot of these things are, you need, of course, to get the book that goes into the background of water fluoridation. It's called The Fluoride Deception. And, of course, I have a new talk I gave going into the background of the water fluoridation and, of course, the danger of fluoride, because, of course, the Clean Air Act does not protect us from fluoride. They specifically deleted it, even though, of course, they know that it produces emphysema and pulmonary fibrosis. But money talks. And, of course, they had hired the most influential propagandist of all time, a man named Edward Bernays, to change our attitude towards fluoride and to change the poison into a panacea, to convince the people that, they could change an industrial pollutant into the promise of a pretty teeth and a perfect smile throughout all time. They changed the perception of the problem. That's what it was all about. And you need to get my talk. It's called on fluoride. It's a talk I have given, and it's got a fancy long name, as I can never remember. It's called The Hidden Agenda, The Fluoride Deception. That is the syllabus, and then the DVD is The History and Toxicity of Water Fluoridation. Anyway, just ask for Dr. Stan's DVD talk, and of course you can get the syllabus we put together, and you get them together. Why, that's even a better situation. The Hidden Agenda syllabus we've been working on for many months. We've got all the documents there, and you need to get this to your dentist. You need to point out that they're not putting sodium fluoride in the water. They're putting fluorosilicic acid. If he doesn't know what they're putting in the water, how can he possibly support it? Because it contains lead and arsenic and cadmium and polonium-20. All the documentation is there. It's a great syllabus. It's called Hidden Agenda. The DVD is called The History and Toxicity of Water Fluoridation. These things are all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then we have a new DVD out. It's called The Coming Crisis. It basically deals with the financial crisis that lies ahead and simply quotes from Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan. And the information you're not going to get, you just call 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Ask about the coming crisis. Are you financially secure? And I would suggest that most people are not. Most people are going to be wiped out of what lies ahead. And, of course, so the DVD on the coming crisis, the DVD on water fluoridation that I did, we have another one, but and then, of course, the syllabus goes without the hidden agenda. The book, GMOs, Beware GMOs, the book, The Seeds of Destruction, and, of course, our four-tape set on genetic engineering, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Be sure to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet and not get anything accomplished. And, of course, there's lots of programs there that are archived, too. We do carry the Big Berkey water filters, and we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Hail, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line from back in Annapolis, Maryland, Pastor David Whitney. David, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Except it's getting a little late back there, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but it's worth getting the word out to Americans all over the country who really are, I'm finding, very interested to discover that the truth has been hidden from them, or actually they've been told lies about the founding of our nation and lies about what the purpose of our government was from the very beginning, lies about what our founding fathers believed. And when they discover the truth and are told the truth, they wake up and take notice and say, what happened to America? How in the world did we get into the position we're in today that is so far removed from the establishment that our founding fathers built over 200 years ago? And you know as well as I that there is forces even at that day that were hard at work trying to undermine the constitutional republic that they were establishing, based all of our rights upon our God-given inalienable rights, not from government, but from God. And that whole view of what government is about to secure those God-given rights has dramatically and for the worse changed in the course of 200 some odd years.
Well, for our listeners who don't know Pastor Whitney, he is, of course, with the Institute of the Constitution. He's an ordained minister. He has his own church. But he spends part-time trying to educate people about the Christian history of this country. Because contrary to everything you are going to read in the controlled media that hates Christianity, contrary to what most of our politicians are going to say, because, of course, they'll pander to the Christians, but most of them hate Christianity as well. But contrary to what you've been taught in school, America was founded as a Christian nation. It was founded by Christians on Christian principles and acknowledging that freedom came from God in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, those things have to be eradicated and removed from our consciousness. And, of course, the Institute of the Constitution is working very hard to bring you the truth about the foundations of our freedom so that we have something to cling to and to reinstitute. Because if we cannot reinstitute our traditional concepts of freedom under God, and that rallying cry of the American battle for independence, no God or no Lord but Lord Jesus, no God but God Jesus, why, of course, we will lose our freedom forever. So you pick up the story from there, David.
We have been talking about the amendments to the Constitution. Of course, the first 10 amendments are the Bill of Rights, which set a very high wall around our constitutional republic, around what was permitted of the federal government, what they could not do, and the areas that they could not invade. And then we talked about the subsequent amendments to that, and I believe we left off at the 27th Amendment, the very last of the amendments, although we know that there's been attempt to make further amendments, like the Equal Rights Amendment, which failed. That did not gained sufficient support and did not gain sufficient vote from the states in order to be ratified in the time span in which it was permitted to be ratified. But the 27th Amendment was ratified in 1992. It basically says that if the Senate and House of Representatives pass a bill to raise their pay, in other words, they give themselves a pay increase, that pay increase cannot go into effect until the next election of representatives has taken place. In other words, the people then could have say, the people could have a vote on whether they approved or disapproved of the senators and representatives giving themselves a pay raise. They could vote them out of office if they didn't believe the pay raise was justified. Well, the interesting thing about the 27th Amendment is it actually was first proposed in 1789, over 200 years before it was actually ratified. So it was one of the originally proposed items to be part of what became the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, and it was not ratified at that time, and 200-plus years later was ratified and has been certified by the director of the U.S. Archives, and could, I suppose, face some sort of challenge in court, because it's kind of strange to allow an amendment to sit there for 200 years and then become ratified. These days, any amendment that's put forward is given a time frame in which it must be ratified, or if it's not ratified in that time frame, then it becomes dead, just as the Equal Rights Amendment is an illustration of in our day.
And, basically, did all the states ratify this? Did they get, what, two-thirds?
Yes, they got the
three-quarters of the states?
They got the three-quarters necessary to ratify it in 1992.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think a court challenge, other than on the amount of time that transpired, there was no time limit put on this, just like there was no time limit put on the first 10 amendments, what became the Bill of Rights. There was no time limit put on this one as well. And I think it's a wise thing that the people have a say in terms of their representatives giving themselves a pay raise, although you and I know that things are so far from the control of the individual and the control of the electorate, we the people who go to the polls, that oftentimes that even the most egregious violations that take place in the Senate and the House, they get reelected. They have the power, they have the money, they have the media in their pocket, and often they're able to manipulate the scene. Even if they are terrible representatives of the people, they still get back into office year after year after year. But the change that's taken place in our land, if we were to enter a time machine, either we go back to the time of our founders, or one of our founders got in a time machine and came to our day, we or they would be quite shocked at the dramatic difference, the dramatic change that has happened in our land. And what has happened is a complete shift, or a seismic shift, you could say, in what is considered law, what is considered good government, what is considered a legitimate function of government. And part of that, there's many streams that have been contributing to that, but part of that began in the middle of the 19th century. We know that Charles Darwin published his book, Origin of the Species, 1859, and it was not a new idea. Many people falsely believe it was new. Actually, it's a religious idea. It goes back to
hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, and we're talking about the basic concepts of our Constitution from which our freedom comes. And Pastor Whitney was talking about the fact that Charles Darwin had written his book, The Origin of the Species. It was published in 1859, and this seemed to be sort of a watershed event for America. So pick up the story there, David.
Well, the proposed theory, and it definitely was a theory, and he admitted it was a theory. He even stated how you could test the theory. If intervening steps of change were not discovered, then his theory would fall flat. He admitted that. But it was just to deal with biology. It was a theory that was only speaking about the biological realm. Herbert Spencer, a contemporary of Charles Darwin, actually took that theory and began to apply it to every area of thinking, every area of academic discipline. So, you know, you get the economic evolution, and you get the evolution of philosophy and evolution of history, and, you know, evolution of every subject matter was what Herbert Spencer was very skillful in promoting, not only in Europe, but eventually those ideas arrived in America not too long after they were being promoted in Europe. And the significant change that happened in our country is when that idea became applied to law. The idea that law evolves over time. And this is a radical concept, very different than what our founding fathers understood, because they saw law as a fixed, constant, unchanging principle. When they said in the Declaration of Independence that they were establishing the foundation of our nation on the laws of nature and of nature's God, they were clearly calling on a fixed standard. We know, because they were reading William Blackstone, what they meant by those two phrases, human conscience, that God's law is written on the human heart from birth of every human being born anywhere in the world. Now, we may see people deaden that conscience or even sear that conscience so it's no longer functioning as a healthy conscience, but they had it at one time and it was clear from their birth. And the second phrase, the law of nature's God, refers to God's revealed law, as Blackstone clearly states, it's the Bible. So that God's word, God's law, was the foundation of our nation, and it is a fixed standard. They spoke in terms of two categories of law. There were the physical laws of the universe that the Creator created, things like gravity and second law, third thermodynamics, and so forth. These laws are fixed and unchanging in the physical universe. So also, the Creator made moral laws. He just didn't make gravity and other physical laws. He made moral laws. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, and so on. And these laws, as well, were as fixed and unchanging. And so the idea introduced into the United States about 10 years after Charles Darwin's publication of Origin of the Species, the idea became introduced that evolution applies to every area of thinking. And when you recognize that it's really a religious idea underlying evolution, then it makes sense, because if it's a religious idea, that affects every area of your thinking. But applied to law, you suddenly have an unfixed standard that changes over time. And that's indeed what the evildoers who wanted to destroy our constitutional republic needed. They needed a way to do it. And they recognized they couldn't really get around the Constitution directly. They couldn't directly change our form of government. Marx was writing about the same time. Actually, he was very excited when the publication of Origin of the Species came about, because it gave him a cover, a scientific cover for his theory of the evolution of human society and human government. He actually wrote letters congratulating Darwin and so on. But Marx's idea became introduced to America as the idea of the evolution of law, that law changes just as supposedly this theory of evolution indicated that changes took place in biology. Now, the first great shot was fired at Harvard University in Massachusetts, and a new president took the throne of Harvard, Charles William Eliot. And Eliot was a firm believer in evolution, even though evolution had not been proven. And he devoted Harvard as a school to advancing the theory of evolution, not just in the biological realm, but in basically every area of thought. So he took evolution and applied it to every area, including law. And for that purpose, he hired a professor who agreed with his point of view about the evolution of law. And that was Christopher Columbus Langdell. Now, this individual is not a very well-known lawyer. He was not successful as an attorney. He was not known as a great scholar in law. The only thing that he had, and the reason Charles William Eliot hired him, is because he was devoted to the same view of the evolution of law, and that he was seeking to change legal education in America. And that's a pretty daunting thing, to think that one man or two men could actually turn the entire education process by which attorneys were trained around in this land, and actually, as a result, change the entire legal landscape, because attorneys are the prime ones who often take elected office, and often, they're usually the ones who are considered to judgeships, and almost obviously they're going to be the law professors of the future. And so to turn and change our form of government, they began at Harvard Law School, and Christopher Columbus Langdell was quickly promoted to dean of the Harvard Law School, the first time Harvard Law ever had a dean. For 25 years, he held forth not only in teaching, but in administrating Harvard Law School, which means he only hired professors who agreed with his point of view, the evolution of law, and fired those who would not teach his point of view. Now, if law evolves, and we know the biological mechanism for evolution, supposedly is survival of the fittest and so on. But in law, they taught that law evolves by the decisions rendered by a judge. Now, if you take any case and you see what the judge has written, right at the top of what judge has written, it's called an opinion, including the Supreme Court. These are opinions. And so the opinions of a judge become the guide by which law evolves.
And, of course, what we're really seeing then is not rule by law, but we're seeing rule by judges.
Exactly.
And whatever the judge's opinion is becomes the law of the land, which is exactly the antithesis of what our founding fathers wanted. And I've been to the Supreme Court building and seen chiseled in stone there, you know, a reference to the permanency of our Constitution. Our Constitution cannot be changed. Well, these wicked people figured, you know, they could really scam the people, giving them the idea that whatever the judge said was law, even though it was in total violation of the Constitution, which the judge had sworn before God to uphold. And this is the great tragedy, is when we have people in the judiciary who have a political agenda. And then they have the audacity to call anybody who wants to support the Constitution a radical. And that's what they did recently with a woman, apparently the Supreme Court judge from California. I don't know whether she's good or bad. But when they call her a radical, an extremist, why? Because she adheres to the Constitution. You realize what this says about the other people.
Yes. And Christopher Columbus Langdell changed legal education, not just at Harvard, but ultimately at almost every law school. There's today one or two exceptions to this, but the way they teach law is very unlike what our founding fathers. Our founding fathers would have studied and did study William Blackstone, John Locke, and other who were basing what they taught upon an absolute standard. In other words, when William Blackstone was writing, he was quoting scripture left and right to ascertain exactly what was law, what was just, what was right. He had a fixed standard. The fixed standard was the law of God, revealed word of God, the Bible. And so from that kind of education where a person training for the bar, a person preparing to become an attorney, would understand that there is a fixed standard of law and it doesn't change. So in every case, the question is, let's go back to the standard and let's apply the standard to this particular case. Well, not so, as Christopher Columbus Langdell was teaching it. He said, law evolves, and the mechanism of the evolution is the opinions written by the judges. Therefore, to study law, you don't go back and study the original intent of what the Constitution said, or the Bill of Rights, or the Declaration, for that matter, because our Declaration is actually stated in law, in the U.S. Code, as the organic law of the land. Instead of going back and studying the original and understanding the original intent, instead, lawyers were trained to study the opinions of judges. It's what's called case law. So you have one case where a judge issues an opinion that is somewhat different than what previously was issued, and then you study the next case that takes the law, again, in a step further. And we see this illustrated today with the Sodomite rites, I guess, is the only way to describe it, at least biblically, that, you know, they have earned their ability to manipulate the system such that certain things have become legal for them that 10 years ago were not legal. And ultimately, last year they got to the Supreme Court to issue their opinion in Lawrence v. Texas that said sodomy, which has been recognized as a crime in all 50 states for hundreds of years, that sodomy is no longer a crime, and therefore any law against sodomy in any state, not just Texas, but any state in the Union, is now illegal. That's an evolution. That's a change. The fixed standard that sodomy is a crime against nature and a crime against God. Why? Because God's law says so. The laws of nature, if nature's God says so. That's now passed. And now we've evolved to a different standard, and they want to even evolve it further to say that gay marriage is the new right, the new development.
And, you know, it's really incredible that these things, not that they're happening, but that there's no outcry from the churches, that the people are not pointing out that these people are violating the law, that we don't just simply withdraw the funds from our law schools because they're not teaching the law or they're perverting the law. And, of course, as we told in the Bible, you know, once the courts became corrupt, then the nation will fall. And that's what happened, you know, in 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. Go back and read 1 Samuel 8 and understand what happened to Israel when the judges were corrupted. Well, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney, we're talking about the Constitution of the United States. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you have a question, a comment, I'm sorry, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you want to reach us, or 464-8295. We've got so many telephone numbers, and every different program we do has a different number. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you want to reach us, that's 800-544-8927. But here in the Central Coast of California, 8314-648295. That's 464-8295. And we're talking about this idea that the Constitution, law, everything around us is evolving. And we no longer have rule by law. We have rule by men. And whatever the judge says is all right. If he says it's all right to have sodomy, that's fine. If he says it's all right to have homosexual marriage, that's fine. If he says it's all right to kill Terry Schiavo, that's all right. If he says it's all right to kill Jews, that's all right, because the judge said it. And, of course, where did the judge get off making law? He is there to interpret the law, and the law is fixed. It was fixed by our founding fathers and was based upon God's law. So pick up the story from there, David.
Well, the way Christopher Columbus Langdell was able to sell this idea, not just to his students, and we'll talk about a couple of his students that were very influential in the seismic change in the legal landscape here in America, but he was able to sell it to law schools all over America and ultimately persuade 99.9% of them to follow his lead that case law, he said, was the scientific way to study law. Implying, of course, that the way our founding fathers studied law and everyone studied law before his time was unscientific. In other words, it was backward, it was primitive, it was, ancient. We want something modern and something new, something scientific. And this is a crazy idea that you can have a science of law, because the whole idea of the scientific method is that you propose a theory, and the theory has no validity except after it's tested multiple times. So you take a theory and you test it, and you retest it, and somebody else retests it, and ultimately, if it's been retested enough time by enough different people under enough different circumstances, so forth, people begin to say, well, it's more than a theory now. This is they'll call it a scientific fact, but we all know that this is usually a squishy place to be, because scientific facts tend to change with new discoveries and so on. But he sold it this way because he knew that there was no way to persuade people very eloquently to reject the standards of our founding fathers, to say, George Washington, he was a Neanderthal. And, we don't want to study what he had to say or what he was looking to as law, because he's ancient. He knew he wouldn't sell it that way to the American people. He needed to put a positive spin on it, and he did by saying, this case method is really the scientific way to study law. But law is not a thing where you can test a theory. Like, well, let's see, should we have a law that says it's a crime to commit murder? Well, let's experiment with that. Let's say it's a crime to commit murder between 5 in the afternoon and 10 o'clock at night. Well, let's experiment with that as a society and see what happens to it.
Well, of course, so much of what we're seeing today is building law based upon science. Like, oh my goodness, we have to have integration of schools because somebody said so. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, really, we were just talking about how law has evolved, and one of the big things that happened to change the foundation of our freedom was, of course, to begin interpreting law based upon scientific studies. And, of course, one of the major stepping stones, one of the major hurdles was the old-fashioned morality that we had built upon the Bible. So along comes, of course, Alfred Kinsey. Alfred Kinsey, who was a Crowleyite, a disciple of Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, and of course Kinsey himself is a homosexual, he's a pedophile, he is into every form of sexual aberration, he's a masochist, which eventually, of course, it leads to his own personal demise, but he does all these phony scientific studies, financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. And, of course, they've done everything they could to keep that information from the American people really for the last half century. But the Rockefeller Foundation financed Kinsey's fraudulent studies, which were then used to change the law, because they would bring these matters up before the courts, and they would say, this has been scientifically proven. 10% of the males are homosexual. Most people are sexually promiscuous. Pedophilia doesn't harm children at all. What's wrong with rape? And step by step, they were able to convince the judges. Maybe they wanted to be convinced, I don't know. But they were able to convince them of things which are totally untenable, are not founded in science, and certainly are destructive to society. And it was this idea of using science to interpret the law rather than the fixed law and God's principles that I believe has brought much of the problem we have today. What do you think about that?
Yes, that's exactly true. And as a matter of fact, one of the students of Christopher Columbus Langdell launched us in this direction of law being determined by social science research. Brandeis is famous for his what's called the Brandeis Brief. The very first time, 1908, was the case Mueller versus Oregon, and he collected empirical data from hundreds of sources, and his report showed that social science authorities and social science data proved the damaging impact of women working long hours and so on. And this was the first time that social science was considered in court, in the Supreme Court in this case, and actually changed the law. And so this Supreme Court brief that Brandeis successfully presented became the model which hundreds and thousands of attorneys after that point in time began to follow, saying, we do social science research, and from that we determine what the facts are and why the law should change.
And
now,
I think
social science is a pretty squishy subject, unlike the hard sciences of physics or astronomy or so on.
And I think it's really so vitally important that people understand that our lawyers never read the Constitution in law school. All they read are the law books that tells what judges have said about the Constitution, mm-hmm. but there's probably not one in a thousand lawyers graduating from law school today who has read the Constitution upon which the laws of the federal government are based. And so can we trust the lawyers? And the answer is no. They need to be re-educated.
Right.
And we've talked to a few now who've gotten the education, like Judge Roy Moore and our mm-hmm. good friend Colonel Ron Ray, and certainly Herb Titus and a few of the others. You know, these are people who've studied the Constitution. But where we're in so much trouble today is that most of our lawyers have accepted these pragmatic ideas, these ideas of evolution, and they do not understand God's law, and they certainly don't understand the laws of our nation.
You know, those who wanted to change our system of government recognized they were going to have to find a cover for doing it and to basically deceive the people, and they used social science because they recognized that it's an easily manipulated field. You're not going to manipulate the scientific research in physics or other things, but, you know, sociology and psychology and all these things today become ultimately the standard by which law is based. So the question of, well, should we put someone to death for a capital crime that they've committed? Well, there's all these sociologists and psychologists that weigh in, and they become the determiners of whether that's a good law or a bad law. This is ridiculous. It's obvious that these people don't have any leg to stand on when it comes to the standard our founding fathers were establishing this country upon. And we have a contract with our government. That contract is a fixed contract, not a living, breathing constitution, as people want to talk about today. And we've got to get back to that fixed standard if we're going to recover our constitutional republic.
And we're going to survive as a nation of free men. And we can almost imagine the Michael Jackson trial with the judge saying, well, yes, he did all of these things, but after all, we have to accept what Alfred Kinsey said, and that pedophilia doesn't hurt anybody. So why are we wasting our time with this? Well, if you honestly think, of course, that pedophilia doesn't think it hurt any harm, you know, these boys have a feeling of guilt all of their lives. But, you know, Alfred Kinsey, who is the basis of so much of the modification of our basic concepts of morality, Alfred Kinsey said, pedophilia is perfectly normal. The only problem is if the parents make a fuss about it. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And when our stations return, we're going to tell you how to get in touch with David, how to get in touch with the Institute, how to set up a program in your community. Because if we cannot reclaim our Constitution, if we cannot teach people about the foundations of our freedom, then we will surely lose it. So why don't you pick up here for a couple of minutes, David, until our stations come back, and then we're going to tell everybody how to get in touch with you and the Institute on the Constitution.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Another very significant student, Brandeis was one student of Christopher Columbus Langdale. Another very significant student is Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., and he was so close in line in the thinking of Christopher Columbus Langdale that Langdale, within 10 years of his entrance to Harvard Law School, hired him as a law professor there at Harvard Law School. Of course, he went on to be a Supreme Court justice, and he and Brandeis were two Supreme Court justices that were in the same camp as Franklin Delano Roosevelt when Delano Roosevelt was trying to pack the court. They were in agreement with his New Deal. All the others were not. So these were people who were working with FDR to undermine our constitutional republic at that point in time in the 20th century. It's interesting to read some of what Oliver Wendell Holmes has said, because he admits the evolution of law is what he stands upon. He's following his teacher Christopher Columbus Langdale lockstep, and he decries morality being confused with law. He says that law ought to be stripped of any language, any moral language whatsoever. Now think about that for a minute. Why do we say that murder is wrong? I mean, why is it wrong to murder? If there isn't any moral reason why murder is wrong, then why in the world do we conclude that murder is wrong? If it isn't the law of God that tells us that murder is wrong, why in the world is it wrong? So his contention that all moral language ought to be stripped out of the law is absolutely preposterous, and yet it's believed by people today. Consider what happened out in Colorado just 2 months ago. The Supreme Court of the state of Colorado threw out a death penalty case because the jury referred to the Bible during their deliberation. In other words, some of the jurors opened their Bible and they read what God's Word said, God's law said, which what our Founding Fathers said, that's the absolute supreme law of the universe. So they read what God's law said, and they made a determination in terms of this death penalty of a rape and murder case. And the Supreme Court threw it out and said, well, that's invalid. These people, they can't look at the Bible. They can't look at God's standard and have anything to do with our legal system. In fact, one of the lead attorneys presenting two oral arguments to the Supreme Court of Colorado said that the jurors went outside the law by trying to find out what God had to say.
Hold that thought right there, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. He was simply talking about a case out in Colorado where the death conviction of a criminal, of a murderer, was thrown out because the jurors, in their deliberation, looked at the Bible. And of course, because they looked at the Bible and they said that God's law said it was wrong, and they let that in any way influence their decision that this vicious murderer should be put to death, why, they threw the case out. And now, you have to understand that we have people on our courts who hate God. And when you understand that, if you understand that so much of what's going on today is an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the Judeo-Christian foundations of this country, then everything makes sense. If you don't understand that, very little makes sense. David, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners about the Institute of the Constitution, how they can get hold of you, and what they really must do if they want to be involved in this effort to save America.
We can save America by educating millions of Americans about what our founders truly believed, and what their standard was, the contract that they formed that we have entered into, our Constitution. And this is done through a 12-week lecture kit. Actually, the lectures are done by constitutional law professor Dr. John Heidsmo, and David Barton does two lectures in addition to that. We've put together a student notebook with a detailed outline of each of those lectures and a host manual. We say you're not teaching this class, you're just hosting it. You put the DVD in and have Dr. Heidsmo and David Barton lecture, and you lead your class through a series of questions. You have the answers to all those. It's a very turnkey program for anyone to do with any audience anywhere. And people can go to our website to order this. It's IOTConline.com. That's IOTConline.com. Or they can also call us toll-free to order our host kit, and that toll-free number is 866-730-9796. Let me repeat that. That toll-free number is 866-730-9796. In addition to our host kit, we have a growing number of other materials available. A radio program that Michael Peruca and myself did on the Ten Commandments and how they are integrated at the start of our nation into the bedrock solid law of our country. Another series that I did on the crisis on the Constitution. We have another one coming out that's going to detail the Bill of Rights and the subsequent amendments to that. So some other materials that can help your listeners get an education about what our founders' vision was, our founders' understanding was, what the terms of the contract. You see, Dr. Stan, most people don't think of our Constitution as a contract because they've been lied to and told it's a living, breathing document. It's nothing of the sort. It's a fixed document with a fixed standard, and the standard must be understood by we the people, because if we don't hold our elected officials accountable to that fixed standard, our elected officials will do whatever they want. We know a bunch of them are criminals, crooks, and liars, and they're going to get away with doing all sorts of criminal things. They're going to get away with violating the terms of the Constitution if we don't know that. So every American, every true citizen should study the Constitution, understand it, know the Bill of Rights, understand what's happened in the process of change in 200 years in our land and why it's happened. The people have been dumbed down. The people do not know the Constitution, and therefore they're not able to hold their elected officials accountable and remove those from office who violate the terms of the contract. If you hired a builder to build a house for you, and you know you had the blueprints laid out and you're going to do this, and he completely ignored that and did whatever he wanted, you'd fire that builder in a heartbeat and you'd drag him into court to get your money back. You had a contract with him. We have a contract. Back in the 90s, they were talking about this contract with America. It's laughable. We already have a contract. The contract is the Constitution. Why didn't they just go back to the Constitution and say, we are going to follow the Constitution according to the original intent of our founding fathers?
Well, I'll tell you why. But one reason was because Newt Gingrich, who was already behind that, is a New Ager. He's a liberal, a socialist, in conservative garb, and when he got all of the new congressmen in back there in 1994 under the Contract of America, he gave them all these books to read, books like books written by Heidi and Alvin Toffler, on the New Age.
Yeah.
But he didn't have him read the Constitution because he didn't believe in the Constitution.
Right.
If you read his writings, in the New Age literature, he dislikes the Bill of Rights. He dislikes the Constitution. He dislikes the Declaration of Independence. But he is one of the major conservative leaders, and it just goes to show you that when they control the media, why they could probably convince us that an orangutan was a conservative Christian. The tragedy is so many of the people say one thing, but they really believe another, and Newt Gingrich is certainly one of those. Needed a contract with America was because not because we were going to be turned to the Constitution, but we were going to push Newt Gingrich's agenda. He headed that group, and of course he betrayed America.
And the thing is, it's sad that he got away with this, because the reason he got away with it is most people in America don't know that the Constitution is a contract, and that's what we need to return to. And that's why we at Institute of the Constitution are dedicated to teaching this across the country.
All right, fine. Well, let's tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution, what they're going to get, and then, of course, how they will go about using your material to educate others. And then we'll get to Jack, who's calling from Michigan.
Yes. They can call us at toll-free 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or order it online at IOTConline.com. They'll get a kit that will enable them to take any group of people. We encourage people to do this in their church, but also in their community centers or public library, anywhere they gather a group of people, even their own living room, gather a group of people together to instruct them about the Founding Fathers, instruct them about the contract that we have so we can accomplish our goal as citizens in restoring this constitutional republic.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And let me commend the information and the program put forward by the Institute of the Constitution. They're doing a great job. Jack, did you have a question for our guest?
Good evening, Jack.
Jack, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dr.
Okay, go ahead.
Ben Franklin, after the Constitutional Convention, stated that a republic, if you can keep it, Ben Franklin was a BAR Esquire, and from what I have gleaned in studying the articles, the articles seem to be pretty clear that what Ben Franklin had intimated is that commercial law, if it ever came to predominate, it would terminate, it would subvert and subjugate the republic, and indeed that's what's happened. Obviously the Federal Reserve, and then the bankruptcy of the corporate United States, made official H.J.R. 192, and FDR by executive order outlawing private ownership of gold as money.
Now, what's your point, Jack?
Well, the point is, since we are now all under commercial law, it is under a de facto color of law statutory legal system that was promulgated and directed by the bar lawyers on behalf of the foreign international banker creditors.
Well, what you're saying is that they've perverted the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Well, the solution here, Dr. Stan, is the knowledge that according to the Constitution, voluntary servitude is just fine. Okay, voluntary servitude via contract, by virtue of Article 1, Section 10, with the private corporate merchant law government that is bankrupted. So,
okay, fine. Let's get David's response to that.
I understand what you're saying, because these things have taken place, but they are unconstitutional, and FDR and the others in power have acted outside the powers that were granted to them by the Constitution. So these people have violated the Constitution. Of course, now they claim, oh, you can't get back to the Constitution because you're under commercial law, and there's ways individuals can get around that, signing every document they've signed with UCC 1-207.4 that states, you know, I retain my constitutional rights by signing this document. I in no way enter into an adhesion contract that I don't know the terms of. So a person can get around that, but the point is, what we're seeking to do is educate Americans about the Constitution, because we can return to the Constitution. It is still the supreme law of the land, in spite of all that you're talking about that has taken place. That has taken place in violation of the Constitution, which means those office holders, FDR and others, have violated their oath of office, and therefore their actions are null and void. But if we act, and, you know, those in power act as if those actions are legal and legitimate, then the myth continues.
And so what we really need to do is educate the people about our Constitution. Educate, educate, educate is really the key. People say we want something dramatic. We want something to happen tomorrow or next week or next month. Well, it took us a long time to get to where we are. And we have to start with the fundamentals. And the fundamentals is first have a personal relationship with our Lord, because understand that our freedom comes from God, no king but King Jesus. And secondly, of course, then understand this wonderful system of government that was bequeathed to us from our founding fathers, and which we either must reclaim or relinquish. And if we do, of course, the flame of freedom dies in our hands. So the key is education. I don't know any better way to do it than the Institute of the Constitution and their program. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney, from the Institute of the Constitution, and he's been talking about how these ideas supposedly were actually evolving and going back to Landel and then Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. And these ideas have been picked up since that time by people who were intent upon destroying America, and then centralizing all power in Washington, D.C., and then using our military power and our financial power to bring about a new world order and a new world religion, because we have people in key positions in corporations and foundations and government, and certainly in our courts, who have no loyalty to the United States, but have this loyalty to this international authoritarian dream. So pick up the story from there, David.
Well, another student of Christopher Columbus Langdell was Learned Hand, and although he never served as a Supreme Court justice, he was so influential that he was often referred to during his lifetime as the 10th justice of the Supreme Court. Well, his greatest legacy is actually founding an institute called the American Law Institute, and its mission, quote-unquote, was to promote and clarify and simplify the law, to better adapt the law to contemporary social needs, to achieve agreement among lawyers on fundamental principles of the common law, and so forth and so on. Basically, he instituted an institute to train lawyers and to change the way lawyers perceive law. And he succeeded. Of course, he was funded by Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, neither of which are any friends of our constitutional republic. But the most damaging work that the American Law Institute ever produced was called the Model Penal Code. And this was the fulcrum for massive change in the legal landscape of our land. You've already talked about Alfred Kinsey. His research was incorporated into the Model Penal Code, and basically almost everything Alfred Kinsey called for in terms of legal changes, legalizing adultery, legalizing sodomy, legalizing incest even, and all these things have become part of the Model Penal Code. And then when that was swallowed lock, stock, and barrel by the states during the 60s and the 70s primarily, it basically became the new law in America. And so people look at America and see the America of the 30s, 40s, and 50s as pretty conservative, focused on families, and families were strong, the morality of the land was strong, and they look at the 60s and they say, what happened? How did this sexual revolution and all this stuff happen? Well, it happened on purpose. It was a plan. Kinsey was part of that plan. The Model Penal Code was changing the laws, which meant rapists, which rape was fairly rare, say in New York City in 1910, there was very few rapes per capita. 1970, rapes just exploded. Why did they explode? Because the law changed, permitting rapists to get away with it. Basically saying that a girl was responsible for the rape. It wasn't the rapist's fault, it was her fault. And these sort of changes were swept in by this Model Penal Code, which, as you've already mentioned, the Kinsey's research was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, and the American Law Institute and their Model Penal Code was also funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. So they had their hands in both sides of this this change in our country that was a change that is devastating. You see marriages falling apart at 50% rate today, and all the other things that that have happened to us as a society as are a result of the change in the law and the change in the mores that have happened as Hollywood has participated in this, which you could say is sodomization of our whole culture to reduce it to sexual perversion. And I'd like to remember, like our listeners to remember, that there's three laws of tyranny. First of all, any power that can be abused will be abused. You got to expect it to happen. Secondly, abuse always expands to fill the limits of resistance to it. That is, if nobody resists the tyranny, it just keeps expanding until it meets with resistance. The third is, if people don't resist the abuses of others, they will have no one to resist the abuses of themselves, and tyranny will prevail. And that's where we've come to, this place where we have to resist. We have to rise up and say, enough is enough. But we cannot do that unless we have a standard. I meet many Americans all the time who are very upset about what's going on in our nation, but they don't have an idea of what can we do? How can we get our nation back? And the reason they don't understand how to do that is they don't understand what our founding fathers designed at the very beginning. So if we go back and study the foundations, we go back and study the understanding and the philosophical and religious beliefs of our founding fathers, if we study those and get back to that in our own thinking and educate millions of others in that same thinking, we can turn our nation back. We can put the evildoers out of office. We can put people who will truly uphold the Constitution into office. We can see that judges are impeached and removed from the bench when they are unconstitutional in their rulings. And we can take back America and restore our constitutional republic.
And as of course Ronald Reagan said so well, if not you, who? And if not now, when? We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program with Pastor David Whitney. And remember, freedom is lost when good people do nothing. And Dottie had assured us that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a time of moral crisis, try to maintain a position of neutrality. What's your position? Are you willing to take a stand with us? Or we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney at the Institute of the Constitution. And, of course, we've been talking about the foundations of our freedom and about how these ideas then, although they were fixed, we got some people in. They were fraudulent, but they set out to convince the American people and the legal profession that laws could evolve exactly as a species had evolved. Well, of course, species haven't evolved. Mm-hmm. Dogs still produce dogs and cats produce cats, and there are no intermediate species, and they've never found them. But, of course, they use this idea of evolution of the species to evolution of law. So pick up the story there, David. We got about 2 minutes.
And so we come to a day now where people, I hope, are waking up to the reality that your God-given rights are not safe and not secure. You might have a little accident like Terry Schiavo did and be incapacitated, and some black-robed lawyer is going to say, well, the quality of life that you possess isn't really up to snuff, and we're just going to rub you out. Our founding fathers said the very purpose for which government exists is to secure your God-given rights, and the very first, the very most important of those God-given rights is the right to life. No one has the right to murder you, including a black-robed lawyer. What comes out of his mouth? There's no justification for that, and yet we have come to a day primarily because we have permitted abortion to go on in this land, which is a violation of the God-given rights of the unborn to life. We have come to a point where most Americans need to wake up very quickly that someday a judge may determine their quality of life just isn't quite up to snuff, and like Terry Schiavo, they will be starved and dehydrated to death. Unless we rise up now, it may be too late for us to make a change and to turn our nation back. And so that's why I encourage your listeners to get a host kit. You can do it. Every person who's listening can do this. It's a doable task. It's not something you've got to have an education, law, or history to do. You can order a host kit and take that host kit to your church. First of all, every church in America that believes the Bible should be doing this, teaching their people what God's law says and what our founders said. So they can do that by calling us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796, or they can actually order the host kit on the web by going to iotconline.com. And if we educate millions of Americans, even despite the problems and the hurdles, we can still return our nation to a constitutional republic. Our founders designed it that way, and they established it in a way that we the people hold the power to return to the standard, that is, to the fixed standard of our Constitution.
Good night, David. Thank you so much. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I hope you all enjoyed our program this evening with David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney. We have them on every month. They certainly support Radio Liberty, and we support what they're doing. We think they're doing a great job. And understand that every day several of these kits are going out, so that every week 10 or 12, 15 kits may be going out all across the country. people are setting up these programs, and once the kits are out, they can be used over and over again. And they've been doing this for 5-6 years now, and more people are relearning what has been taken out of our schools, has been taken out of our universities, and that is, of course, the wonderful heritage, about the wonderful heritage of freedom that we receive from generations past, with the hope that we will be able to, of course, pass that on to generations yet unborn. I support the Institute of the Constitution. I hope you will, too. Well, yeah, right now, of course, I want to mention some of the things we have that will help you better to understand our form of government. We have a four-tape set called The Foundations of Our Freedom. That's the four-tape set. And it's where I do a series of interviews with Dr. James Herson, and he did a great job here. We have a book, America's God and Country, by William Federer. And if you have not yet read it, it's a book I keep very close to me as I sit here alone in the studio every evening, America's God and Country. And we have it not only in book, we actually have it on a CD, so you can actually put it on your computer. A lot more information there. And then, of course, we have David Barton's Original Intent, going into the background of this myth of the wall of separation of church and state. We have a book written by a lawyer on the wall of separation. So that's America's God and Country, the Original Intent, and then the wall of separation. We have other books, like a book on abandonment theology by John Salfont, with the idea, and it's really true, that the church has abandoned America. We have a wonderful book by Tim LaHaye, The Faith of Our Founding Fathers, and it goes into each one and his proclamation, his assertion of his faith. And we're talking about men who lived well over 200 years ago, and yet they were Christians. And if you go down the list of all the founding fathers, other than Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and Tom Paine, who I did not consider a founding father, he was a rabble-rouser and a revolutionary, a very eloquent one, but he wasn't around here when America was being created as a nation. He was over in France stirring up a revolution because he was deeply involved in the occult. In fact, the Georgia Guidestones are dedicated to Thomas Paine. Those at the Rosicrucian monument there in Elberton, Georgia, where they talk about maintaining the world population at 500 million. In constant balance with nature, which is another way of saying we're going to kill off 90% of the world's population. But other than Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson, why every other person who signed the Declaration, and all but one individual who signed the Constitution, all of them were evangelical Christians or coming from the Catholic persuasion. But you're never going to hear that in school. Why? Because the schools, the purpose of our schools is not to tell the children, our children, the children of this nation, the truth about it, but of course to turn them against America, to convince them that our nation was founded by deists. And how often you'll see that, if you go up on the internet, you'll see all these articles about the deists who founded our nation, and it's all a lie. But a lie told often enough will be accepted. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get the books we talked about, America's God and Country, The Faith of Our Founding Fathers, Original Intent, The Wall of Separation, and first John's, Chalfont's book, Abandonment Theology. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. If you'd like a free newsletter, give us a call. We'll send it to you. 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.